No, it's
This is an interview with Professor Emeritus Edward Omer Halterman, School of Veterinary Medicine, Purdue University, held on December 6, 1988, in the Trustees Room, Stewart Center, Purdue University. The interviewer is Ann E. Kirker, Professor and Veterinary Medical Librarian Emerita. Ed, from reading your biography, I know that you were born in Michigan and received the DVM degree from Michigan State University in 1952. Would you tell us something about your background?
And like all veterinarians, I'm an animal lover. Like most veterinarians of my day and before, I was raised on a farm in which animals were central to our way of living. In our case, it was a dairy farm in Upper Michigan. We lived closely and continuously with those animals. We worked for them as well as they provided for us. This mutual dependency fostered a relationship which is quite different from what is professed by animal lovers, in quotes, of today. We might have used the term love for animals somewhat in the same context as we now say we love our work. We were deeply involved with our cows, our horses, the other animals on which we depended. We cared for them in the very best way we knew. We sheltered them, we fed them, we studied them, we bred them, we nursed them, we cleaned their manure, and in the end we sold them or we killed them and ate them. In high school, maybe before, I had a lively interest in science and had some vague aspiration of being a chemist. But I graduated at 16 years of age in 1935 at the depths of the Depression. Although our farm provided us a good living in terms of food and shelter, we were almost outside of the money economy. Higher education seemed to be out of the question. In fact, about two-thirds of my peers didn't even finish high school. So I helped build our farm. I worked temporarily on a fox ranch, where, incidentally, I met virologist Richard Ott, who was studying a new disease of foxes that eventually turned out to be fox encephalitis, caused by the same virus as that of canine hepatitis. I found this interesting, but I was on the bull gang, employed for my muscle and not my curiosity. So I earned my 35 cents an hour by hauling feed bags and catching foxes, and not by helping the young Dr. Ott as I would have liked. Another thing that happened on the Hiawatha fur farm was that a fox bit my hand, so I went to the local physician. Through this and several other minor accidents over the years, the doctor and I became friendly, and he suggested I studied medicine, but it seemed out of the question at the time.
You were a young man during the years of World War II. Did you serve in the armed forces?
Yes, when the war began, I enlisted in the Navy and became a pharmacist mate. I served two of my 4 years on independent duty on an amphibious ship, an LST. During those years, I met a lot of physicians, some of whom I admired greatly. One, especially an Army officer named Major Stott, was on my ship for a couple of months going into the invasion of Leyte in the Philippines. Major Stott was a born teacher as well as a fine doctor. And almost every afternoon after sick call, he'd sit up on my examination and hold a session on my examination table and hold a session with me and his corpsman. He'd start with something like, let's talk about burns. And he'd spend an hour or two reviewing the physiology and treatment of burns, or malaria, or tsutsugumushi, or other subjects that were important and interesting to us at the time. He made a terrific impression on me. He was a wonderful role model.
Were you able to utilize the GI Bill to further your education?
Yeah, after the war, Vi, who had been an Army nurse serving in France, and I were married. The GI Bill made further education possible. I would have liked to study medicine, but by this time I was 28 years old, and the 7 or 8 years it took to get an MD seemed too long. We decided that Veterinary medicine was a profession in which I could combine my love for animals and my interest in medicine and science. At that time, only 1 year of pre-vet was required, and I could accomplish the DVM in the 5 academic years of GI Bill support that I had earned with my time in the Navy. These years I spent at Michigan State for the training leading to the DVM.
Did you practice your profession before you came to Purdue for graduate study?
No, Ann, I did not go into practice. I went all the way through school, or almost all the way through school, with the idea of setting up a dairy practice around Green Bay, Wisconsin. But it never materialized.
When did you first become interested in Purdue?
Well, during our last quarter in vet school, Dr. L. M. Pat Hutchings, new head of the veterinary science department at Purdue, came up to MSU on a recruiting trip. He and Dr. L. P. Doyle had recently identified transmissible gastroenteritis, that's TGE, as a specific viral disease of pigs. And this, along with Pat's work on brucellosis and other work mostly by Doyle, had given the department national recognition. They had received some federal money to support this research, and he was looking for graduate students to help with the work. Bob Claflin and I were the number one and two men academically in our class, and we both decided to go look at Purdue. Bob had also committed himself to an interview with a small animal practitioner in Chicago, so we did not go together. Instead, Robert G. Carlson, also a classmate, drove down with me for the ride.
Ed, did you like what you saw? And tell us what came of it.
Well, what we saw wasn't terribly impressive. The old Vet Path building, which still exists, was there. There's a new ADDL building. A few old buildings that had been used to house pigs when all of the hog cholera serum and virus for Indiana were made by the Vet Science Department. We got here at noon. Nobody was here, but when we met the people, we liked them, especially Pat Hutchings and Dr. Doyle. It turned out that all three of us joined the department. Bob Carlson worked on bovine viral diarrhea with Bill Pritchard, and on completing his PhD went up to Upjohn, where he spent his entire career. Bob Claflin worked on atrophic rhinitis of pigs, which was another rather poorly understood disease of the time, and I worked on TGE with Doyle and Hutchings.
Can you tell us what the veterinary science department was like back in those days?
Well, the vet science was a department in the School of Agriculture. For the most part, we are proud to be identified with the School of Agriculture, and especially with the Ag Experiment Station. Our job was to teach 3 or 4 undergraduate courses in anatomy, physiology, and animal hygiene to ag students, to do extension work, most of which was speaking on control of animal diseases to farm groups, to operate the Indiana Animal Disease Diagnostic Laboratory, and mainly to research diseases that were economically important to agriculture. We had an enthusiastic group, mostly young, with Dr. Doyle as the elder, who we greatly respected, Dr. Daly in a diagnostic lab, always giving us kindly advice, Dr. Fred Walkie brightened up the scene with his great sense of humor, and Pat Hutchings was our chief. We worked very hard. The normal work week was 5.5 days, including Saturday morning, but our labs and offices were usually busy at night. On Saturday afternoons and Sunday mornings, the parking lot would be almost empty, but it would fill up on Sunday afternoons as we started another week's work or hurried to meet another deadline. Nevertheless, we were an enthusiastic, interested group, and we enjoyed our work, most of it.
Can you give us some interesting sidelights of your diagnostic work?
I could give a lot of them, but I remember one Saturday afternoon when I was on my regular rotating duty in the diagnostic lab. Just about noon, When I was about ready to close shop, a farmer appeared with two large dead steers in the beginning stages of decomposition. Even if we had had a refrigerator large enough to hold them, there was no way I could leave them, so I spent the rest of that Saturday on a necropsy floor with two very smelly steers.
I bet you didn't like that very well. Who were some of the animal scientists, aside from the veterinary science faculty, with whom you worked?
Frederick Andrews, who later became vice president for research at the university, was in the animal science department. But he was housed with his graduate students in our building. He and Pat Hutchings were good friends, and his graduate students, especially Martin Stobe and Jim Franzen, were part of our family. Dr. Andrews' area was reproductive physiology. Several of us took courses from him, which he delivered with a clipped New England accent. He was a valuable member of my graduate committee. Several of us also studied with Dr. M.X. Zero of the biology department. Most of us took his two courses, one of which was basic endocrinology, the other one was research methods. Gerald Getch, George Neer, who at that time was Zero's grad student, Bob Claflin, and I took that course together. Mike, as we called him, Zero, had devised a number of laboratory experiments in endocrinology, so that although some of those experiments ran for several weeks, one was terminated each week. And we were required every Monday morning to submit a paper on the week's experiment, written as though for publication, complete with review of the literature, introduction, procedure, results, and conclusions. In addition, we were to carry out and report on an original experiment of our own during the semester. We worked for 40 to 50 hours a week on that one course. Mike Zero worked right with us. It was a lot of work considering we all had other jobs to do and our own research, which sort of took a back seat for a while. But we agreed that it was one of the most useful courses we had. It was grinding work, but it gave us some tools in experimental design and reporting that were all important in our trade.
What was Dr. Donham's role in the Veterinary Science Department and the School of Agriculture?
Dr. Charles Rumpel Donham was head of the Veterinary Science Department until he had a severe heart attack about 1950. And he was replaced in that capacity by Pat Hutchings. A great deal of the credit for establishing the School of Veterinary Medicine should go to him. Before and even after his illness, he traveled over Indiana speaking mostly to farm groups and emphasizing that a vet school was possible and that the place for it was Purdue. Dr. Donham took his life about 1958. It's my feeling that he was depressed by his forced inactivity. He had been a leader in the profession and was unhappy at being confined to an office with little to do while the rest of us hustled around him.
What was the role of women in the department?
Well, it was a time of limited opportunity for women in the profession. We had three professional women working with us, though none of them were vets. Olive Stull Davis was an interesting person. She had a PhD in herpetology from the University of Michigan. She carried out research on the avian leucosis complex, and when she developed a lymphosarcoma, she was convinced that she had been infected with an agent through her work. And she spent the rest of her research career attempting to transmit lymphatic tumors to various experimental animals without success. She taught histology for several years in the veterinary school after it was established and eventually succumbed to the tumor. Olive Davis was a beautiful woman. She was also a poet, and as we came to recognize through her long bout with cancer, she could be tough. Dr. Doris Bunnell was another researcher who started as a technician for Pat Hutchings in the veterinary science department, and she used this opportunity to earn her PhD. She had worked as Pat Hutchings' technician and eventually became an authority on porcine brucellosis in her own right, but retired when she married. Another, Ann Heimlich, started as Dr. Washko's technician and earned her master's degree with us and went on to her PhD in biology, and she's still in the biology department. Mostly our women were technicians and clerical workers. Most of the technicians had degrees in some area of biology and chemistry. Many were wives of grad students in other areas. They were, of course, extremely important in our work and in our society.
Can you tell us something about the rapport that existed among the staff in the old days?
Twice each day, we had coffee in a large room on the second floor. Everyone who could get away, from the department head to animal caretakers, gathered around a large table and visited, sometimes about work, more often about anything else of interest. It led to a real sense of belonging to the department. This propinquity also led to a few romances. I lost my all-time best technician when Barbara married Bob Claflin. Leslie Morton Pat Hutchins was our department head during those years before we had the vet school. He was the person who set the tone of the outfit. He had a great sense of humor, a fantastic memory for names and faces, a genuine concern for his people, and loyalty that I sometimes thought was excessive. He came out of Maine. He never lost his down east accent. Maybe he cultivated it. He visited every person in his lab almost every day. He knew what was happening. He knew the directions of their work. He did not interfere. He gave the impression he was there to help. I thought he was the best boss I ever had.
When did Dr. Hutchings' illness become evident?
Sometime during 1958, he developed some swelling of lymph nodes. Biopsy showed it was lymphosarcoma. He went to Billings Hospital at the University of Chicago, where he was treated with nitrogen mustard. This, and perhaps other treatment, was followed by a very severe reaction. In spite of his misery, he maintained a lively interest in the emerging school of veterinary medicine and in the students who had been admitted to the first class. At the time of his illness, I was assistant dean, acting as dean in his absence. I drove to Billings Hospital in Chicago two or three times a week during his stay there. He always had questions about individual students. Characteristically, he was concerned about each one of them as individuals. He died on July 28, 1959, at 43 years of age, about a month before classes started. It was a terrible tragedy to us, his friends and colleagues, to his wife Mary, to his three sons. He was known, respected, and mourned by literally hundreds of people in the profession all over the country.
When were you appointed acting dean?
I was never so appointed. In 1957, when I was still a graduate instructor, Dr. Hutchings made me assistant department head. And in 1958, I became assistant dean when Pat was named dean. My duties were to be in the area of organizing and supervising research. I took on this job rather reluctantly. I had no experience or particular desire to be an administrator, but Pat convinced me that I could do it, and he would give me all the help I needed. When he died, the administrative setup of the school had been established with Dr. Hutchings as dean, me as assistant dean, four department heads, George Christensen in anatomy, Robert Claflin in microbiology, pathology, and public health, Gerald Getch, physiology and pharmacology, and John F. Bullard in clinics, which included both food and pet animals. My job, as I saw it then, was to work with the administrative group as a committee, to make such daily decisions as were necessary, to work up a budget for the next year, to approve requisitions, to represent us to the new university administration. I also met monthly with deans of the university and the president, and served on the university promotions committee, which consisted of deans and one or possibly two faculty other than deans. Fortunately, we had a very excellent secretary. Charlotte Brighton had worked with Dr. Hutchings for about 2 years and knew all about keeping the books and handling other things with which I was only vaguely familiar. She and two typists did all the work that it seems to take about 30 people to do nowadays. In 1960, At the time the new dean came aboard, we hired a comptroller's assistant, Walter Belts, to take care of fiscal matters, but during the time before, we did it ourselves.
How was the new dean selected? Was there a search committee appointed?
We did not have a search committee. None of us had any administrative experience nor any aspirations of being dean, although I did try to promote Dr. Christensen, who I thought was the best qualified among us. This did not get much support from others in our group. Another person I supported was Dr. William Pritchard, who had been with us previously. He was then serving as head of the Veterinary Science Department in Florida. Both of these men later became outstanding administrators. Pritchard as Dean of Veterinary Medicine in California, and Christensen as Vice President of Iowa State University. It was, I believe, President Hovde's prerogative to name the dean, and he leaned mainly on Earl Butts, Dean of Agriculture, for advice. As it came about, J. Carroll Bottoms of the Ag Econ Department visited Iowa State, where Erskine Morse was recommended to him as a candidate. He, Dr. Morse, appeared here with relatively little consultation among us and was approved as our dean. I remember going to all of the faculty members in the school to ask him if he had any objection to his being appointed dean. None did, and that was about all the input we had. Dr. Erskine Morse became dean in May 1960.
What was the role of extension in the department and in the school?
Well, Dr. Fred Hall, who had been a very progressive practitioner in Garrett, Indiana, was appointed extension veterinarian in 1952. His job was largely to interact with the state's practitioners and farmers. He did this mainly by involving himself in their district and state meetings and by meeting with farm groups, which were arranged by county agents. Maybe all of us were expected to contribute in this area. I believe that 10% of my salary was contributed by Ag Extension. Usually Dr. Hall and or others of us went to a gathering of farmers in a local school building along with a person from the Animal Science Department. The object was to convey practical information on disease control and husbandry directly to the users. I believe this and other extension activities had a profound effect on the development of agriculture in the state and in the country. Another activity in which we were all involved was the annual 2 or 3 day meeting conducted for veterinarians in the state. For this, we brought in several authorities upon whatever subjects we highlighted for the year, and many of us would report on our own research. This meeting had been held every year since 1913 and has continued since the school was established. This conference was a well-attended educational opportunity for practitioners and a cohesive force for the profession. Early on, this meeting was called a short course, but for several years has been referred to as the annual conference.
What was the relationship of the Animal Disease Diagnostic Laboratory, which we refer to as ADDL, to the new school?
The ADDL was an entity of itself with its own building and a separate budget. All of the professors in the ADDL had dual appointments with the veterinary school. It was regarded as a valuable teaching facility for professional students as well as grad students in pathology and microbiology while serving as a state's official animal disease laboratory.
I believe there was a vet research farm on the South River Road. What was the use made of that?
Well, in the veterinary science department, almost all of our work involved experimental animals. In virology, for instance, the use of cell cultures to grow and detect viruses was in its infancy. And the only way we could detect these viruses was to infect animals and observe them for typical responses. We used animals for all our work in pathology, pathogenesis, toxicity, physiology, and to some extent diagnosis. It was important to have animals that were healthy before experimentation, that were free from immunity to the disease being studied, in some cases of a particular genetic background. Dr. Hutchings, with Dr. R.B. Stewart's good help, acquired a large property on South River Road. Bruce Hatcher, who had recently earned his M.S. degree in animal science, was our very competent farm manager.
Would you describe some of the work done on specific pathogen-free animals on the farm?
Well, several of our projects involve swine. Bob Claflin and I set about establishing a herd of what was then called disease-free antibody-devoid swine by G.A. Young of Nebraska, who had developed a technique of taking pigs by hysterectomy and raising them in isolation from other pigs. We modified his technique and established a herd of such pigs. We delivered the pigs by hysterectomy, raised them in isolation units, and when they were about 6 weeks old, placed them in a clean, isolated area on the farm. We used the progeny of these pigs for our research work. During the second summer we had this herd, there was an outbreak of erysipelas in the pigs. It was probably brought into the herd by wild animals or birds, but we were never able to determine the source. We were, however, able to save the herd by treatment, but it no longer qualified as, quotes, disease-free. The fact that erysipelas had been in the herd did not limit its usefulness for research on transmissible gastroenteritis, which was my main interest, or atrophic rhinitis, which was Claflin's. But since the herd was no longer disease-free, if it ever was, we used the term, quote, specific pathogen-free, quote, in our next annual report. This term, often abbreviated to SPF, has been and is widely used to connote pigs and other animals, especially laboratory animals raised under similar circumstances to which we developed. Dr. Bill Pritchard also established a group of cattle by this means, but this was less practical, mainly because of the low reproductive rate of cattle. Eventually, the cattle facilities were used in studies of respiratory disease. A flock of SPF chickens was also established to provide eggs for diagnostic virology and research. Besides these SPF animals, there was a small flock of sheep which was used for parasitology research and as blood donors, and a band of ponies.
What was the role of graduate students during the 50s and later in the school after 1959?
Most of our grad students had a DVM before they started as graduate instructors. We had very few people who were technicians who were permitted to take courses and do a research project and eventually earned graduate degrees. The graduate instructor in the 50s did little teaching, although I believe Dr. Goetsch taught a course in physiology. They were, in fact, the mainsprings of research that was ongoing. In contrast to some other schools, we were expected to start on research immediately, and in some cases, especially at the PhD level, develop our own projects and help hunt for funds. We were also expected to do a small amount of extension work, assist regularly in the postmortem lab of the ADDL, help with some of the animal work. Some of us helped to do the veterinary work for the university's flocks and herds. For a couple of years, I did the reproductive work on the dairy herds of Penny Perdue Farm at Wanata and Herbert Davis Farm at Farmland. And of course, we were involved in planning for the new school. All of this was good experience, but I sometimes wonder when we had time to study. With the advent of the school, graduate instructors were required to assist in teaching, mainly in laboratories, but also to give some lectures. I do not remember that any of them had responsibility for a course. They were still important and productive workers. Of course, as we added more professors, they had their graduate students, and their duties varied considerably with each situation, so it's difficult to generalize. I would say their work was mainly in their research and their studies and some teaching, and except for grad students in pathology who worked in the ADDL, they are not heavily involved in outside work.
Yeah. The establishment of a professional school to train veterinarians at Purdue was seriously considered by the Board of Trustees as early as 1948, at which time I believe a committee of trustees and faculty was appointed to study the problem. Is this your recollection, Ed?
Yes, bills are introduced in the Indiana legislature as early as 1951. I believe the bill died in committee during its biennial sessions from 1951 to 1957, but was finally funded in the amount of $2 million in the 1957 budget.
What was the reaction of Dr. Hutchings and his staff?
Well, the general reaction of the vet science staff was very favorable. They saw it as an opportunity to promote their interests and those of the profession. I had some misgivings because I felt that the country needed research more than more veterinarians. With hindsight, I'm quite sure that more research was accomplished with the school in place than would have been done in the institute that I envisioned.
Were President Hovde and other members of the university administration encouraged by this appropriation?
Well, President Hovde, of course, was elated at the passage of the Appropriation Act to start the vet school. During an interview with him shortly before his death, he told me that he considered the establishment of the school one of the more significant achievements of his tenure. He also said that he had envisioned Pat Hutchings as his successor to the presidency of the university.
What preliminary plans were initiated?
Well, after the shouting was over, we had to start planning. The school was no longer a pipe dream, it was real. And all of us, faculty and senior graduate students, were involved. Several of the staff visited existing vet schools to discuss physical facilities. Of those they saw, they liked Cornell's recent addition best. Dr. Finch, a Cornell clinician, was hired as a consultant, and his influence may be seen in the similarity of our clinic to theirs. Dr. Gerald Goetz was given the task of being point man, who took our crude ideas of space and function to the architect and vice versa. It was a full-time job covering thousands of details that go into such a building.
Was the Indiana Farm Bureau active in the preliminary negotiations for the establishment of the school?
Yes, the Indiana Farm Bureau was the organized group that pressured the legislature, the only one I remember outside of the university. They considered essential that there be enough veterinarians to keep a healthy animal agriculture in the state, and they thought a veterinary school would provide it.
Were there some prospective students who were active in lobbying with the legislature?
Yes, there was an active group of students who were seeking admission to the veterinary school, to a veterinary school. There was great competition for entry into all veterinary schools, and students from states without a school had a difficult time getting in. Some of the students lobbied the legislature. Unfortunately, two of the most prominent members of this group were not accepted into the school after it was established.
Who from the Purdue administration lobbied for the establishment of a school?
As far as I know, the lobbying per se was done by John Hicks. I'm sure President Hovde and Pat Hutchings expressed their sentiments to appropriate persons. Very likely others did too, but I was not aware of it.
What was the attitude of practitioners in Indiana?
I don't remember any practitioners campaigning for the vet school. If there were any, they weren't very vocal. I think most of them were apprehensive that a glut of veterinarians would give them more competition than they wanted.
What was the major source of opposition?
I don't know of opposition except for a few vocal veterinary practitioners. I don't think the Indiana Veterinary Medical Association said anything officially one way or the other. I suppose, as always, there was competition for limited funds in the legislature, and this could have engendered opposition, but I can't pinpoint it.
How was the original appropriation of the $2 million used?
And they used it to dig a hole for the basement and build a shell. This was a maneuver by Hutchings and Hovde to force the legislature to complete the school facilities. Some new schools of the time, Missouri and Minnesota that I know of, started with meager buildings and obtained the remainder of facilities piecemeal over many long years.
Were additional appropriations made during subsequent legislative sessions of the Indiana Assembly?
Yes. 2 years later, an additional $3.4 million, I believe was that, was appropriated. This covered completion of the building and equipping it with cabinets and so forth, and also some of the research buildings, animal holding and isolation buildings particularly.
When was the groundbreaking ceremony? Would you give us some personal observations about it?
On February 21st, 1958, it was a typical cold February day. The architect had erected a sign with a picture of the proposed school on it. There were some brief speeches, mercifully brief because of the cold, I believe, and all the dignitaries were presented with gold-painted shovels with which they spaded a couple of shovels full of dirt. I don't remember any great crowd. Of course, all of the staff were present.
Who were some of the celebrities who were here?
The dignitaries were, as I recall, Governor Harold Hanley, Dr. Lowell Barnes, who was a federal veterinarian in charge of Indiana, John Hardenberg of the AVMA, George Dalp of the Farm Bureau, Dr. Russell Portman, who was a local practitioner, Dr. Joe Green, who was a state veterinarian, Drs. Frank Booth and Lowell Hinchman of the Indiana Veterinary Medical Association, Dr. Larry Borst of the State Senate Finance Committee, Dr. Hutchings and Dr. Hovde.
Were all of the faculty members from the Department of Veterinary Science of the School of Agriculture taken into the faculty of the newly established School of Veterinary Medicine?
Yes, I believe that all of us who were there at the time were taken into the school. As always, there were some coming and going of staff in the early years.
What were the major areas of research in the new school? Were these largely continuations of research projects from the Department of Veterinary Science?
The major new areas of research in the first couple of years were in anatomy with Dr. Christensen and in parasitology when Dr. Goffer came aboard. Otherwise, research on infectious diseases and physiology were essentially continuations of work in a veterinary science department. Of course, as the school expanded, new faculty brought their interests and approaches, so that eventually there was a much broader spectrum of research in the school.
Who were involved in establishing the curriculum for the new professional school?
A committee. As I remember, it was Dr. Claflin, Dr. Gustafson, Dr. Christensen, Dr. Getch, Dr. Moses, Dr. Bullard, and myself. The curriculum we developed was fairly classical and typical of those in most other veterinary schools at the time. Later, perhaps 10 years later, there was an extensive revision of the curriculum.
What temporary classrooms and laboratories were provided before the new construction was completed? Was the first class admitted in the fall of 1959 the only one to use temporary facilities?
Yes, that's the only one who used temporary facilities. We used room 112 in a veterinary path building for lectures. The top floor of the veterinary path building was used for anatomy lab. Room 203, that's Dr. Goffer's lab now, was used as a microbiology lab for the first year. This course was taught by Dr. Harold Moses.
Were many new faculty members brought in?
In a period just prior to the opening of the school, Dr. Christensen and Dr. Goffer were new members. Dr. Andre Lavignette and Dr. Annis were small animal clinicians. They came aboard shortly after the school opened. There were, of course, many others as the school developed.
Who was involved in the selection of the members of the first class?
We had an admissions committee. Dean Hutchings was actively involved, and I don't remember the rest of the committee members.
Approximately how many applicants were there, and were there any women who applied for admission to the first class?
Again, I have to confess I don't remember the number. We had a fairly large group from which to select the first class because of a backlog. It was much smaller than we would experience during the 1960s and during the late 60s and the 70s. The applicant pool in the first few years after the first class was disappointingly low, but by the late 60s, we had 7 or 8 applicants for each position. I remember only one woman applicant for the first class. Very likely there were more, but she was not accepted.
Would you comment on the educational background, the average age, and experience of the applicants for this first class?
Well, the first class was composed largely of men who had been trying to get into veterinary school for several years. Consequently, they were older than subsequent students. Many of them had degrees, and some of them had been working in various positions before they started in veterinary school.
Would you tell us about the expectations for utilization of the medical illustration unit in the academic and research activities of the emerging school?
Well, the medical illustration unit was a rather new idea for veterinary schools at the time. Dr. Hutchings and the administrative group, I think, had the idea of an illustrator as a sort of a super technician. But when we interviewed Algernon Allen, as I remember, he wanted his alpha to have more stature. He insisted that he be given professorial rank. He was a highly trained professional artist and, as it turned out, a good aggressive administrator. He joined the faculty in 1959. He gathered a group of artists and photographers and electronic technicians that became perhaps the best such group in any veterinary school in the country. I remember going to meetings such as a conference of research workers in animal disease, where our illustrative material was the envy of the whole meeting. Others had slides that were upside down, print too small, too much data per slide, obscure pictures. Ours were always neat, clear, succinct. The unit grew to occupy a whole wing on the ground floor. I would be hard put to measure the impact of this group on the progress of this school. It certainly made us a leader in this respect. I am sure it still is one of the very best in the country.
What role did the Veterinary Medical Library play in the programs of the school?
Well, the library was another unit of which we were very proud. All of us recognize the library as basic to all education. I'm not sure how Pat Hutchings contacted you, Ann Kirker, but he certainly made a good choice. As was the case with medical illustration, the library grew beyond my vision. I was used to a reading room such as we had in the Vet Science Department and at Michigan State, where we had bound volumes of perhaps 20 or 30 journals and about 100 textbooks. What emerged under Professor Kirker's direction was a complete medical library. I haven't visited other vet libraries recently, but I would be surprised if ours is not one of the best and most complete of any in the country. Anne ran a real tight ship. Everything was neat, everything in order. The help was always courteous. If you could not find something, somebody found it for you. If it was not in our library, then from some other source. She established a non-smoking policy, which I considered a minor hardship at the time, but with which I now concur wholeheartedly. I spent many productive hours in the library and still go in now and again, although I find my interest to be more general now. I spend more time in the West Lafayette Public Library. I've loved libraries ever since I was a kid. I will say to you, Anne, thanks, Anne, for making a great part of our life at the vet school.
Thank you, Ed, for your kind words. Building the Veterinary Science and Medicine Library is one of the great satisfactions of my professional career. For the record, it might be of interest to fill in a few details. My first career was as a medical technologist after receiving the BS degree with a major in microbiology from Purdue in 1933. I spent 20-odd years at the Arnett Clinic and in foreign service with the medical department of Standard Oil as a med tech. When I returned home from abroad in 1956, I started to work in the old AES library as a stopgap measure until I decided what graduate program I should embark on and where. With a great deal of encouragement from Dr. Pat Hutchings and Purdue Library Director Mr. Jack Moriarty, I started work at the University of Illinois in the Graduate School of Library Science. I did this in summer sessions and on a commuting basis while continuing to work at AES. My MS degree and the entrance of the first class coincided in the summer of 1959. Ed, in 1973, you were awarded an honorary doctorate by the State University of Ghent in Belgium. Would you comment on this prestigious honor and the events leading up to your selection?
The honorary doctorate came as a very pleasant surprise. The University of Ghent has an annual celebration of its founding at which four persons are awarded the doctor honoris causa, and of course I was really proud to be selected as one of them. Cited was my work in my lab that first described lactogenic immunity and on the pathogenesis of transmissible gastroenteritis, which became the model for understanding how several viruses interact with intestinal cells to cause acute malabsorptive diarrheal disease. My chief advocate at the University of Ghent was Maurice Pensert, who was my graduate student here and is now professor of virology there. Another grad student, Bill Hooper, made the serendipitous discovery of shortening of the intestinal villi in TGE-infected gut while looking for acridine orange staining differences between infected and not infected tissue. He extended this into a very significant thesis, which really developed into our work on pathogenesis. It's a case of a student's making a professor look good.
Thank you, Ed, for your interest and cooperation in making this interview possible. A record of the early years leading up to the establishment of the School of Veterinary Medicine, as well as that of the initial years of its existence, is a resource of great historical value to the school and the university. The tapes and transcription of the interview will become a part of the university archives at Purdue, which assures a lasting recognition of the role you and other faculty and staff played in the formative years.
Thank you, Anne, for this opportunity to review the accomplished as well as some of the problems of what to me has been a very interesting career.
This is the end of the interview with Professor Emeritus Edward Omer Halterman. The interviewer was Anne E. Kirker.